A Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are focusing on a truly foundational text in resilience and mental health, Martin Seligman's Learned Optimism, How to Change Your Mind and Your Life.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about, you know, just motivational posters here.
Yeah.
This is a deep dive into a scientifically validated methodology for, well, basically rewiring your mind.
Absolutely. This book, it's essentially an instruction manual for psychological resilience. The core mission really is to answer a critical human question. Why, when two people face the exact same setback, like a job loss, a critical review, maybe an illness, why does one person feel defeated, sort of passively withdraw, while the other one instantly pivots, maybe even thrives?
And the answer, according to, well, decades of research by Dr. Seligman, it lies not in some fixed personality trait, but in our cognitive habits, specifically what he calls your explanatory style. And the relevance of this work right now, I mean, it feels immense. If we accept that optimism is actually a skill, it means we have a direct, scientifically backed method for building genuine resilience rather than just, you know, hoping we were born with it.
And to really appreciate the power of this discovery, you kind of have to trace Seligman's intellectual journey. He's one of the most respected psychologists in the world.
Oh, for sure. Former president of the American Psychological Association.
Right. And widely credited as the father of positive psychology.
But what makes his perspective so distinct, I think, is that he started his career studying pretty much the opposite of flourishing.
That's the fascinating part.
Back in the 1960s, his famous research was focused on learned helplessness.
Exactly. He demonstrated through empirical work, initially with laboratory animals and later observed in humans, that if an individual is repeatedly exposed to negative events they believe they can't control, they eventually just stop trying. They become passive, depressed, helpless, even when a clear path to escape or improve is finally presented. They just sort of surrender their agency.
Yeah, that early work was profound, but also quite dark, wasn't it? It identified the mechanism of misery, really.
It did.
The genius of learned optimism is that it represents his intellectual pivot. If helplessness can be learned,
then logically,
then optimism must be a skill that can be taught and practiced.
Precisely. And his authority is rooted in that rigorous transition. He isn't just offering like abstract advice. He's translating decades of empirical research on what causes misery into an actionable roadmap for flourishing.
So this book is really the critical bridge between his early negative research and, well, the later formation of the entire positive psychology movement.
That's a great way to put it.
So when you pick up Learned Optimism, what you're getting is this kind of hybrid text, right? It's a deep scientific exploration of how the human mind processes failure, but packaged as a practical, actionable guide.
Yeah. And the central premise, as we touched on, it revolves around the explanatory style, that internal dialogue, that narrative we use to assign causes to the good and bad events in our lives.
Right.
The book argues, quite forcefully actually, that this narrative style is the main lever determining whether we default to being passive or active, pessimistic or, well, resilient.
And the promise of shifting that style is incredibly broad. Yeah. I mean, the sources point out that by mastering this process, you can improve everything from your ability to recover from professional setbacks.
Yeah, huge for careers.
To alleviating symptoms of depression and anxiety, and even strengthening your physiological response to stress. It's designed as a tool for, well, pretty much every segment of life, from the classroom to the boardroom.
Absolutely. It has wide application.
Okay, let's unpack the core diagnostic tool of a book then. Seligman defines the difference between optimists and pessimists using the three P's. These are the dimensions on which we interpret adversity.
Right. The three P's, we can think of the first two as kind of defining the scope of the damage, you know. So the first P is permanence. This deals with time. When something bad happens, the pessimist tends to see the cause as fixed, lasting. Like, I'm always awful at public speaking.
Always, never. Those kinds of words.
Exactly. The optimist, on the other hand, views the cause as temporary. I just had a difficult presentation today. They assume the setback will pass. It's transient.
Okay, so temporary versus permanent. That's the first one.
The second P is pervasiveness. This concerns scope. So it's the difference between specific and universal.
Oh, yeah.
The pessimist allows a failure in one area, let's say for getting to pay a bill, to kind of spread, to infect their entire self-image. I'm completely incompetent at life.
Catastrophizing.
Totally. The optimist compartmentalizes. They view the cause as specific. I messed up on that specific administrative task. It doesn't bleed into everything else.
Got it. Specific versus global, essentially. And
Yeah.
the third P.
The third P is personalization. This is all about blame. When adversity strikes, pessimists tend to internalize the blame. It's entirely my fault. I am stupid.
Owning it in a destructive way.
Yeah, exactly. Optimists are more likely to attribute the failure to external factors, maybe bad luck, difficult circumstances, or just the complexity of the task itself, not necessarily denying responsibility, but not making it about a fundamental flaw in them.
That third P raises an important point, though. How do we avoid the flip side? Just blaming everything else and never taking responsibility.
Yeah.
Where does Seligman draw that line between externalizing blame and healthy self-reflection?
That's a really crucial distinction. And Seligman is careful here. He isn't suggesting you blame the universe for everything, not at all. He argues that chronic self-blaming internalization is what's psychologically destructive and leads to that helplessness we talked about. Healthy self-reflection means asking, okay, what specific action can I change next time?
Action-oriented.
Right. Rather than concluding, I am permanently flawed. So the difference is finding a temporary, specific, maybe external cause versus assuming it's a permanent, pervasive internal flaw. It's about accuracy, not just feeling good.
That makes sense. It's nuanced.
And it's precisely because these three habits, permanence, pervasiveness, and personalization, are measurable that Seligman was able to demonstrate the theory's power in a real-world setting.
Like sales.
Exactly. A high rejection environment like sales is just a perfect laboratory for resilience, isn't it?
Which leads us straight to that famous MetLife study, right? Involving insurance sales agents. That job is just a constant barrage of no, leading to notoriously high turnover. Seligman's team used a test, the ASQ, I think it's called, to measure the explanatory style of prospective agents.
Yes, the attributional style questionnaire.
Right. And the key finding was, well, pretty startling. The optimistic explanatory style was a much better predictor of success and tenure than the company's traditional aptitude screening.
Way better.
In fact, they had this special group of new hires who scored high on optimism, even if they actually failed the standard industry test.
Which is amazing.
They outperformed the pessimistic agents by up to 88% in sales volume.
88%. That data point is just staggering evidence that mindset can trump aptitude, at least in these kinds of high-pressure fields, resilience, quantified.
So the crucial question then becomes, how do you actually install this resilient mindset if it's learnable?
And that's where Seligman gives us the practical method, the ABCDE model. He really stresses that the core component here is active disputation, not just, passive wishful thinking.
Not just think positive.
Definitely not. It starts with defining the situation. A is adversity. That's the objective event, like, say, you missed a deadline.
Okay.
B is belief. That's your automatic, often pessimistic interpretation. Oh, great, I'm always going to miss deadlines. I'm terrible at time management.
The immediate negative thought.
Exactly. And C is consequence. That's the resulting feeling, maybe panic or anxiety, or the resulting action, like just giving up on the project. And crucially, C is caused by B, not A. Your panic isn't directly caused by the missed deadline itself. It's caused by your belief that you're a failure because you missed it.
That separation is key, isn't it?
It's everything. To break that chain, we move to D for disputation.
Okay.
This is the cognitive martial art, as you put it earlier, maybe, where you actively argue against your pessimistic belief, like you're cross-examining it.
Okay, how do you do that?
He gives four main tactics. First, ask for evidence. What are the cold, hard facts supporting your belief that you are always going to miss deadlines? Usually, the evidence is pretty thin when you look closely.
Right. Maybe you missed this one, but met the last five.
Precisely. Second, seek alternatives. What's a less personal, less permanent explanation? Maybe the timeline was unrealistic this time, or perhaps you were given incomplete resources, or something unexpected came up.
Okay.
Third, consider the implications. Decatastrophize. Will this single missed deadline truly ruin your entire career? Probably not. What are the real likely consequences?
Get realistic about the fallout.
Exactly. And finally, question the usefulness. Is believing I am a failure actually helping you solve the problem right now? Is it motivating you? The answer is almost always no.
No, it probably just makes you feel worse and less likely to try again.
Right. And the goal of successful disputation, of challenging those beliefs, leads to E for energization.
Ah, the E.
Yes. By successfully reframing B, you feel more hopeful, motivated, ready to take constructive action. You transform that feeling of helplessness into agency. You feel energized to fix it or move forward.
That ABCDE framework seems really practical. You can almost walk yourself through it in the moment.
You absolutely can. It takes practice, like any skill, but it's very doable.
So thinking about the bigger picture here, the major thing that really struck me while diving into this is the profound sense of agency it provides, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The book's core message really is that optimism is a skill, not a fixed destiny. It completely overturns that old idea that we're just victims of our moods or our upbringing.
Absolutely. That's the most empowering takeaway, I think. And the impact of that agency, it's surprisingly comprehensive. It extends far beyond the purely psychological.
You mean physically, too?
Yes. The book makes a compelling case for the physiological benefits. Optimism is associated with a more robust response to stress and even a stronger immune system.
Really? How does that work?
Well, the thinking is partly behavioral. Optimists might be more likely to seek help, to follow through on healthy behaviors like exercise or doctor's advice, because they trust their actions will yield positive results. Pessimists might think, why bother? It won't work anyway.
That makes sense. Your belief affects your actions, which affects your health.
Exactly. Plus, there's likely a direct stress response connection, too. Chronic pessimism can mean chronic stress activation.
Another key message that stood out was the concept of flexible optimism. Seligman is quite careful, isn't he, not to promote just blind, unrealistic positivity.
Very careful. He acknowledges there are situations, you know, think about an airline pilot doing a pre-flight check, or an engineer assessing structural integrity, or maybe a financial forecaster.
Right, you want realism there.
You definitely want realism, even a degree of cautious, critical assessment. Pessimism, or at least realism, has its place. It can be protective.
Oh.
However, for the majority of challenges in life pursuing goals, maintaining relationships, recovering from inevitable setbacks, optimism is demonstrably the superior growth-oriented strategy. It's about choosing your explanatory style strategically based on the demands of the situation, not being optimistic about absolutely everything all the time.
So it's about appropriateness, not just positivity for its own sake.
Precisely.
This work is just filled with really quotable insights, isn't it? Lines that stick with you.
Oh, definitely. For instance, summarizing the three P's, he notes, the defining characteristic of pessimists is that they tend to believe bad events will last a long time, will undermine everything they do, and are their own fault.
Boom. That just instantly gives you the diagnostic framework for negative self-talk right there.
It really does.
And here's one that captures the transformative power, I think. It's a startling thought that we can determine our own destiny by the way we think about it.
Mm-hmm. That really reinforces that the power lies within our cognitive control. Agency again.
Yeah.
And perhaps the most crucial therapeutic separation, the core idea from the ABC model is this. The crucial C consequence, what you feel and what you do, is not caused directly by the A adversity.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, C is caused by your B belief about the adversity.
If you can truly internalize that separation.
You unlock the ability to change C. It puts you back in the driver's seat.
And finally, Seligman connects this personal skill to something broader, doesn't he? He says something like, optimism is invaluable for the meaningful life. With a firm belief in a positive future, you can throw yourself into the service of that which is larger than you are.
Yeah, that's powerful. It suggests optimism isn't just about personal success or feeling good. It's actually the fuel for purpose, for contributing to something beyond yourself.
Okay, now let's get really practical. How can we put this to work in everyday life? Let's talk parenting and education.
Great example.
So if a child struggles with a subject, maybe math, a pessimistic message from a teacher or parent might be, oh, you just don't have a knack for math.
Right. You hear that kind of thing.
And that just hits all three pessimistic Mia.
Yeah.
It sounds permanent, always struggle, pervasive, bad at math, not just this topic, and personal, you don't have the knack.
Exactly. It shuts down effort. But an optimistic reframing uses those principles of disputation we talked about.
How would that sound?
It might sound like, okay, you found the section on fractions difficult. That means we need to change your study strategy for fractions.
Specific and temporary.
Right. Failure is reframed as temporary and specific feedback on strategy, not a permanent verdict on their identity or overall ability. It keeps the door open for improvement.
That's a huge shift for a kid.
Massive. And this is also vital for adults trying to adopt, say, healthy habits where relapse is pretty common.
Oh, yeah. Like dieting or quitting smoking.
Exactly. Imagine you're on a new diet, doing great, and then one evening you just completely derail it, binge eating or whatever.
Happens to the best of us.
The immediate pessimistic belief is often, ugh, I have no willpower. I've completely ruined everything. Might as well give up.
Total derailment.
But using the ABCDE model, you dispute that belief. A is the derailment. B is, I have no willpower. C is feeling hopeless, giving up. D is where you argue back.
So you'd say?
You'd say, okay, this was one meal, specific, temporary. I ate well for the last 5 days. Evidence. What alternative explanation is there? Maybe I was overly stressed today. Alternative. What are the real implications? I might gain a tiny bit back, but it doesn't ruin everything. Implications. Is believing I have no willpower helpful? No usefulness.
And E, energization.
E is feeling okay about it and thinking, right, I'll just resume my goal tomorrow morning, rather than letting that one lapse define the whole journey and lead to total abandonment. That resilience prevents minor setbacks from becoming catastrophic failures.
That's so applicable. And what about in our relationships? How does explanatory style play out there?
Hugely important. It acts as a buffer against conflict escalation. Think about when your partner or a friend comes home grumpy.
Okay.
A pessimistic explanatory style might lead you to personalize it immediately. They're mad at me. What did I do? Our relationship must be fragile. Permanent, pervasive, personal again.
Spiraling.
Exactly. An optimist is more likely to externalize it, at least initially. Wow, they must have had a truly awful day at work, or maybe they're just tired. Temporary, specific, external.
So it stops you from jumping to conclusions about the relationship itself.
Right. It prevents minor external stresses from being misinterpreted as major relationship crises. It allows for empathy rather than defensiveness.
That's a really useful way to think about handling everyday friction.
Definitely.
You know, looking back at the research Seligman presents, what truly surprised me was that evidence showing optimistic students, after facing some academic setback, actually perform better going forward than pessimistic students,
mm-hmm.
even when their baseline intelligence or aptitude scores were identical.
That's right. It's powerful stuff.
It just proves that the explanatory style, the mindset, is the active ingredient in learning and recovery, maybe even more than raw aptitude sometimes.
It really highlights the power of how we interpret events.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the most profound lesson overall is just that realization that our mindset isn't fixed. It's highly malleable. It's subject to conscious control.
That's learnable.
Exactly. The power lies in mastering disputation. That's the action verb. It's the tool that transforms an automatic negative thought loop into constructive, goal-oriented motivation. It turns feelings into action.
Which really leads us to our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to consider.
If our ability to rebound from rejection, our explanatory style, predicts career success in fields like sales, even better than traditional aptitude tests or maybe even technical skills,
yeah.
What does this tell you about the kind of training we should prioritize, not just in schools for the next generation, but in our own lives right now? Where should the focus be?
Food for thought indeed. See you next time for another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.